Joining me in the studio is our Director of Public Works, Mr. Mike Miller. And how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
That's good. I was looking at the city newsletter, and I saw on there where they were talking about storm response. And one of the comments that made in there that fortunately we didn't have the ice in that they did on the other side of the tunnel. But we still had a lot of issues with rain and wind and power outages a little bit here and there. Talk a little bit about the public works response. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, public works is an 8-to-5 job, and I think we probably should know that that's not the case.
That is not the case. So we are available 24/7, 365 days a year. We respond to emergencies, of course, and we have staff that's always available, in case there is an emergency. So we are highly trained. Our staff is, multi-versed in several different responses, whether it's, weather-related as far as, wind response or a snow response, slick roads. So let's kind of back up. When we were looking at this event going into that weekend of January, I believe that was January 12th, we were prepared. So if the weather had changed, if we had gotten that lower temperature and we had, whether it was freezing rain or snow, we always prefer snow. It's easier for us to deal with, obviously, like everybody. But we were prepared if we did get freezing rain and ice, how would we respond? And we don't have a whole lot of tools. We are on the Central Oregon coast, but we do have a piece of equipment. It's our patch truck for patching roads. So it's a large truck that we can put hot mix asphalt in and keep it warm to do repairs with. It also has a device that goes on the back of it that's a spreader for putting down traction aid. For us, traction aid is basically a quarter inch minus chip rock. It's actually quarter 10, which means that it doesn't have a whole lot of fine material. It's really quarter inch rock that's clean. And then we can go and spread that and put that down just like, the state puts down traction aid sanding rock, what they call sanding rock. It's not really sand. It's an actual rock material, quarter inch or 3/8 inch.
Now, if you have to end up doing that, do you then have to come back and sweep all that up later?
We do. Yeah. So you put it down and then, as vehicles are going over the rock, it does push it out to the side. So we put down a nice layer. We do have to probably make several attempts throughout the day of putting it down. And that's what it was. That's what happened last February, end of February, when we had the snow. We had to go out and do multiple applications of traction aid to make sure that there was enough aid so that people, didn't lose grip on the roadways.
Now, because 101 and 126 are state highways, do you have to deal with that as much, or does the state do that and you do the side roads?
We do the side. So we do our own city-maintained roads. The nice thing is we do have a great relationship with ODOT. So ODOT will take care of Highway 101 and 126. They will also, because they have the mag chloride, so that's the liquid de-icer, they will go and they will help us out and they'll pre-treat city roads such as 9th Street. Because they know that that
hospital
is the
and
hospital
police.
And police department. So they will pre-treat that for us on our, for our benefit. They will also hit 35th Street as well. But the rest of the streets is up to the city to maintain as far as a traction aid. And we only use the sanding rock. We do not have mag chloride. We do not apply mag chloride on city streets.
Does that require some, if you were to, extra permitting and things like that?
No, it's just extra equipment.
Storage equipment.
Of mag chloride, a truck with spray equipment. We're set up for herbicide application for maintaining our rights of way, and we do very little of that, but we're not set up for putting down mag chloride on a roadway. That's a specialty with a tanker truck with a spray nozzles and pumps and everything.
Like the big wide ones you see going on the road, and they spread out and they kind of hit everything.
We don't have that type of equipment, and we really don't have that need.
How does a potential emergency situation unfold? Like, for example, do you have certain people that either sign up or are put on an on-call list for certain periods of time, or is it a rotation kind of thing, like it's your turn? How do you know who to have on when that's the time?
So when we know it in advance, we do set up and have staff that will volunteer for different schedules. Typically, though, we do watch the weather, and we are amateur meteorologists, but we do rely upon the National Weather Service, and we get really great information from them of tracking of the weather so that we know what to expect. And then we also track other weather outlets, whether that's weather.com and some other tools. We do track multiple weather forecasting for our area. Rely heavily upon National Weather Service out of Portland. They've done a really good job for us. But we do have some other tools, and we do track that. And if we know that there's an event coming up, we will assign folks and have them on standby and ready to come in. And then if it's the heat of the moment, then of course we're scheduling and rotating folks through on a, whether it's a 12-hour shift or coming in to do just a little bit of work and then be able to go back home.
What kind of event is forecast where you say to the staff, hey, this is an all hands on deck, be prepared, everybody? Is it, heavy windstorms? What kind of situations come up that it would be like, okay, everybody be ready just in case?
So big driver for us is the windstorms, of course. So we do scope that out and we say, hey, this is happening, especially if we have that indication that it's coming in at the end of the day or during the day, then it makes it a lot easier for scheduling. If it's expected to come in at, 10 o'clock at night, then we keep it pretty loose. We do have people that are targeted to be on call that we can rely on that we do call out in the heat of the moment. But we also have to protect our own workers. So, if it's a windstorm and, the winds are howling at 100 miles an hour, I'm not sending folks out. We will wait until it subsides to send the crews because I have to protect my crews. I have to protect that individual. We don't want to put them in harm's way. Although, our job is to clear the roads, and that's our main focus. But we do try to be strategic because it can get very scary, to the point where folks just – it's not safe for them to be out. If the trees are blowing and swaying very heavily, we don't want them to get them in harm's way where we have an accident. Nothing worse than having a responder be involved in an accident. So we do try to judge and make those judgment calls of when they will actually go out. If we have a road down, we will go out with a crew, with equipment and push material out of the road to reopen it. But having strategic people going around and cutting limbs, cutting debris out of the roadway, chipping it on site, that may wait a little bit until the winds die down.
Yeah, because I know you never know. I noticed Robbie Wright at HIAC had put some photos up of his truck and house that had a tree fall on it. You never know when one of those windblown trees is going to come over, and it could be somewhere where you're working or potentially, already have an issue going on there.
Yes.
In recent years, can you recall a story of a big event that was like sticks in your mind that's like, oh man, we had to go out. We had to have everybody out there for this.
Yeah, so we've had a couple. We've had the probably the big wind event. I think that was in 2012. I think that was in January 2012. We had the big wind event. It was memorable in the fact that it came in the middle of the night. We had some folks out that were called in early to come to work, but that was also the event where it drove home the fact that certain areas of town can be isolated. So that day we had high winds. We lost trees on Rhododendron Drive down by Green Trees that took out power and blocked the roadway. And we, Public Works, we have to wait for power to come out and de-energize those lines before we can touch them. So there is a wait. And so with that happening at that time, we also had trees on Rhododendron up towards Fun Ridge that came down and blocked the road. And then we had trees on Hasita Beach Road that came down and blocked the road. And that is a county response and county responsibility, but they're also waiting for Central Lincoln PUD to de-energize. Because, again, we have to wait for the power to be turned off before we touch those trees.
I know recently in Portland, the family that got killed because they went back for a baby that was in a car, slipped, contacted the lines. That's very, very dangerous.
Very dangerous. So we do have to wait for that energy to be de-energized. But at that time, I was headed into work myself. I live out in that area, and there was no way to get into town. I mean, down at Green Trees, it was blocked at 35th and Rhododendron just south, or I should say east of Rhododendron Drive. There was a tree down. Ultimately, the person that was trapped in the truck perished. It was after the event. They'd never recovered from their injuries, but a tree came down and crushed the vehicle. And so there was no way to get to Highway 101. And as public works director, I threw out my public works director card and got around the area, but it was totally blocked off. Mm-hmm. They had, emergency services had that area blocked off. You could not go, like I said, you could not get out to, even if you could get out to Hasita Beach Road, it was blocked. So, 2,000, 3,000 folks were kind of captive and kind of drove home the fact that we needed another route between 35th and Hasita Beach Road to get people out of that area. And that's reflected in our transportation system plan.
Now, when I first moved here, people mentioned Cascadia subduction zone. I'm sure that was there. But it wasn't until, I think it was the Wall Street Journal or New York Times print some big article, and then all of a sudden everybody starts talking about the potential of the 9.0 and thing happens. How do you plan? Obviously, we hope it doesn't happen, but obviously you have to have a contingency and plan for that. How do you guys prepare for that, and how do you do ongoing training? Do you just kind of, I don't know, just give me a ballpark of what happens with that.
So we do. So Cascadia, there is a playbook from the state dealing with Cascadia. Very high level, what to expect and what to play out. We do.
But every area is going to have a different.
Every area is different, yes. Yeah. In Florence, it's not the tsunami as much as it is the earthquake. What is this community going to look like with, the trees down, earthquake of a magnitude of 9.0 or greater, or even 8.5 or 8 and greater? What is that really going to look like for this community? We are built on sand. How are the buildings going to fare? A lot of buildings were constructed prior to some of the earthquake codes that we currently have. So how is this community going to really look, after that shaking? We're not so much worried about the tsunami because we know how far that's going to come in. And yes, there will be impacts, but not to the degree, say, Seaside or Cannon Beach or some of these other very low-level communities. We will have issues up north, Driftwood Shores, those areas. But, the community itself, what is it going to look like? And so we do. We do tabletop exercises. We work with fire and ambulance and all of our partners and talk about, what this is going to look like for us and what that response may look like. And knowing that we're going to be isolated for an extended period of time.
Especially if a bridge.
Especially look at,
the
bridges.
Even if a bridge doesn't go out, the roads are going to be messed up anyway.
The roads are going to be messed up. You look at, slides in the foothills of the Coast Range. The tunnel is probably going to not be accessible. 36 is not going to be accessible. It's just kind of given, especially when you look at what happened with this last ice event and all the trees that came down and just kind of, with a shaking event, how that may look like.
Increase probably, yes. what the problems are going to be. Tell me if this is a misnomer and if I'm misunderstanding this. I had read somewhere or heard somewhere that out in the ocean along Florence, north to south, there's like a shelf there that could potentially divert some of the damage a tsunami would do. Is that something accurate? Have you heard that, or is that?
I have not heard that.
Okay.
Well,
I mean, if it were, I'm sure you would have heard it.
Yes.
Because I had heard that before. That the last tsunami warning they had, it hit farther down south from us, and they were expecting it to hit here. So I guess somebody thought that it must have been due to some of the way the ocean floor was set in this area. So, but if you haven't heard that, then we'll just pretend that I was just misinformed there. So when it comes to preparedness, I mean, we talk about this all the time. I'm sure we have spots on the air that talk about getting ready for stuff. And I guess in the last 5 years or so, they increased it from 3 days to 2 weeks, to get ready for that. What are the current recommendations for people that live along here?
So definitely a minimum 2 weeks. Might need to think longer term than that.
Based on whether it's Cascadia or just another natural disaster.
Right.
Okay.
Right. If it's Cascadia, you need to plan in excess of 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We're going to be by ourselves for a very long time.
Well, just look at how long 126 was closed.
Yes.
And what people don't understand is even if the roads here are open, Fred Meyer, Safeway are going to run out of food. They don't have that supply back for that. So you can't depend on that.
You can't depend on it. So, if you have the ability and you can have the storage for, for freeze dried goods, 30 days, mm-hmm. Is really what you should be looking at. 2 weeks is a great start. Hopefully by then we would have, we would have the federal
assistance
from, you know, from the Navy. They would be bringing in, you know, supplies off the coast and bringing them into town. Again, you know, at Public Works, you know, we have a cache of food supply, you know, dry goods up in, you know, up in our pantry, so that we can ensure that, you know, we are able to take care of our staff. Of course, we encourage our staff, you know, they have to take care of their own families, obviously. But if they're at work, we're going to make sure that they're fed and they have that nutrition, to keep them going, because it's going to be a long time before we see relief.
I know at this point I'm going to be eating a lot of garbanzos, kidneys, pintos, green beans, canned corn. I mean, that's, you know, that would be my situation right there. But yeah, I can understand that that's important. And I guess water is also important.
Water is also, yes.
And yeah. One of the things that people are like, oh, I forgot about the water.
Yeah. Water is always important. And there's, I mean, the nice thing is there are consumer products out there, whether they're life straws, they're different things.
Waste to purify.
That you can buy off the shelf to secure a water supply for yourself, yes.
And if nothing else, if you can build a fire and boil it, you know, you can do that. You we have a lake right outside our house, so if need be, a few pans of water.
There we go.
I might not get a shower, but I'll definitely have something to drink.
There we go.
Mike Miller, thank you so much for stopping in today. Appreciate it. It's always good to know that, you know, it's not an 8-to-5 job with you folks there, and you guys are always ready. So thank
always
you.
Ready.
Thank
Got
you so
phone,
much.
Phone right by my bed.
There you go.
All right.
Hopefully it doesn't ring too often. Right?
There we go.
Thank you, Mike.
You bet.
And we'll continue with our city folks with Chantel Meyer next, talking about Art Exposed.